Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
It's not right.
So 2020 might look a lot like 2019, according to our next guest. David LeDuc is here, Chief Investment Officer of Active Fixed Income at Mellon, based in Boston, in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio on this. It's kind of a Fed Tuesday because we're awaiting some comments from Jay Powell from the NAB annual meeting. David, nice to have you here. What do you think we need to hear from Jay Powell right now?
Well, I think the question Jay Powell's probably asking himself is, you know, how am I going to thread the needle on my comments today and, not really telegraph too much. I think a year ago we were talking at this same luncheon.
It was in Boston last year,
and it was at this same luncheon where he talked about how great the economy was going and really set expectations for a lot of rate hikes, and that's partly what led to a lot of volatility we had at the end of the year. So my sense is, if that memory is still in his head, he's probably weighing his words carefully. My sense is that, you know, if you look at the recent comments, I don't think that they'll be particularly different, which is he's pointed out the fact that the economy in the U.S. is in a good place, I think, in quotes.
Right.
And he's also pointed out the fact that the uncertainty around trade remains one of the risks that are weighing on their policy decisions.
So, but what can the Fed do about that? And that goes back to the story that I pointed out at the beginning of our show, that we might be headed, if we are headed for a recession, it might be different this time around, and one that not necessarily that the Fed's tools can deal with, especially if it's around trade policy and geopolitical tensions.
I agree. I think there's a lot of expectations that lower rates, easier monetary policy in and of themselves can offset a lot of this uncertainty about the future, and I'm not really sure that that's true. I don't think that we have a cost of capital problem, right? Rates are really, really, really low. So providing, easier credit and a lot lower interest rates, I'm not sure if that's going to do enough to offset concerns about, the future for demand, right, which is what trade is upset at the moment.
You know, it was interesting, and Carol and I were both in this New York Bureau meeting earlier, and we were talking about sort of the big stories that we've been following, and one of them that I have to say that's really caught so many people's attention is this whole negative yield story. It's a global story. Yep. It's been driven by a lot of our coverage here in New York. Tell us how that plays through to your investment thesis, what you make of it, and what sort of everyday investors should make of it.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we get this question a lot right now. I think investors have seen that yields around the world, right? There's a lot of stories. There's $17 trillion now of negative yielding debt around the world. So we've got a lot of questions from clients about, can that happen in the U.S., and what am I going to do? And I think the implications are pretty pretty tough for investors, right? It's already a low yield environment, and you've seen investors increasingly stretch into less liquid, more riskier assets like high yield and loans and other markets to try to find some kind of yield. We don't think that we're headed to negative yields here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of differences demographically between markets like Japan and Europe, where they have older populations. The productivity is a little bit better here. Inflation's closer to target in the U.S. So we don't really see that in the future. But in general, I think we've had, you know, a negative term premium in rate markets, and so rates are a lot lower than they probably should be given where the economy has been. And that's presented a problem for investors. And unfortunately, I think the implication of the negative yields around the world means is it probably caps yields here, right?
Right.
Because investors all around the world are looking for places where yields are higher. And the U.S. is a pretty broad market.
So 154 on the 10-year in the U.S., I'm going to take that, right, considering what the global backdrop is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, now if you're a global investor in the U.S., you can buy some of these markets and hedge those yields back into the U.S., and I won't get into the math of that, but you can actually earn a little bit higher yield. But in general in the world, right, if you're a global investor, and particularly if you know, those investors that need high-quality assets, banks, financial institutions, you know, your choices are very limited to find anything with a positive yield right now in global markets. And so I think that that environment globally will continue to keep U.S. yields. It's one of the factors that will keep U.S. yields lower than mm-hmm. they probably should be. And it probably means that for investors, they have to adjust their return expectations.
And talk to me about trade, because clearly that is playing through the market sentiment. And, you know, increasingly we were talking with one of our colleagues, Brad Davis, earlier from our breaking news desk about how, you know, you're starting to see it play through railroad stocks. You know, you're starting to see it sort of pop up in maybe not unexpected, but meaningful ways. It even feels like it's somehow, at least indirectly, entering into the world of sports with all this basketball controversy, which I'm sure, being from Boston, you follow the NBA pretty closely.
Yes.
But what does it look like from an investor's perspective, Trey?
Yeah. What it, you know, for us, what it looks like is, I think it looks very similar to what it looks like for Powell, which is this hard to quantify unknown, right? It carries huge risks around it, but it's hard to put a number on it, and which is, it makes both, you know, being a central banker hard, and it makes being an investor hard, because you don't really know what the potential impact is. If you look at the actual impact of the tariffs that are likely to go into place in October, you know, a couple of tenths of GDP, those in and of themselves aren't enough, I think, to derail our expectations for growth in 2020, which is maybe a little bit less than 2%. More what the issue is the companies that we talk to, all of them, you know, being more hesitant on their hiring plans, is the sentiment that really is the thing that I think has the ability to that uncertainty is more what's going to impact the economy than the statistics or the dollars.
But we've done a lot of reporting about specific companies, whether it's in the ag sector or FedEx, talking about specifically that trade is impacting
for
the bottom
sure.
line.
Yep.
We have to leave it there, or actually, we don't have to leave it there.
No, let's keep going.
What I do want to ask you is, we keep talking about, everybody expects some kind of deal to be done between the U.S. and China.
Yep.
What if we don't get a deal? What if we are at this turning point and things are going to be very different going forward? And China is not manufacturing everything like we used to, so we're not tapping into that cheap labor. And they're also not necessarily going to be buying as much from the United States.
Right.
If that changes longer term, what do we as investors need to understand about that?
I think the main implication from that is the trajectory of global growth is lower than it might be, right? Potential, long-term potential growth is lower into that scenario than it might be, right? I think globalization, by any economist measure, has been good for global growth, right? You know, I think economics 101, the law of comparative advantages, right? Yeah, some better than others, and it's not that there haven't been abuses, and it's not, I mean, I think there's a lot of sympathy for some of the issues on this trade dispute with China among all our partners, right? Europe, UK, Japan, they all have similar concerns around, you know, technology and some of those issues. But in general, global a more open global environment has added to global growth. And so I think if you roll back globalization, if the world becomes more unilateral in that way, I think you have to knock down your long-term global growth expectations.
Well, and it's interesting. I think you are among those who expect some good growth from India. We were talking about this earlier. We've been talking about it now for a couple of weeks, in part because we were able to sit down with one of the leading business folks over in India, Anand Mahindra, and he was essentially saying India stands to benefit tremendously from a lot of this back and forth between the U.S. and China.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think particularly within the Asia region, right? Yeah. I think if that region ends up being, more isolated, right? If all these trade issues result they're talking about different standards on wireless, right? All these different things are going to have the effect of making Asia a little bit more insulated, and that's a big opportunity for India.
What's your favorite fixed income play right now?
Our favorite fixed income play is going up into quality, high quality assets. So we've been going up in quality and high quality corporate bonds, particularly financials and utilities, so non-cyclical sectors. And we still like securitized assets like mortgages and other markets. Things that are higher quality, things where you get paid for risks that aren't tied to the potential for a global slowdown.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Dave LeDuc is Chief Investment Officer of Active Fixed Income at Mellon. He's based up in Boston, down here on the lower part of the Acela Corridor in New York City today.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
This is normally about the time that we start talking about Business Week economics. We've been talking a lot about Business Week economics.
Yes.
So let's get some reaction to what we heard from Fed Chair Jay Powell, from Kathleen Hayes, Global Economics and Policy Editor for Bloomberg, and Carl Riccadonna, Chief U.S. Economist for Bloomberg Economics. They're both in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So, Kathleen, I want to start with you. You were sitting here with us for most of that Q&A, especially. What jumped out at you? What did you scribble down there?
I thought it was a fun speech. I love the fact that when he was a young guy starting out as an assistant Treasury Secretary job, he was so lucky that Paul Volcker took him under his arm. I love the fact that he spends all weekend reading all this stuff. That stuff is color interesting. Not much impact on the bond market.
There I will
was
say
small
on, the,
rally.
On Volcker for just one second,
sure.
A nice shout out to Paul Volcker's book, which
yes,
is
said,
out, which is a great read.
Read it.
And written in conjunction with our colleague Christine Harper.
Absolutely.
Just to brag on her
Thank
a little
gosh,
bit.
Gosh, because he'd never done that without Christine. Maybe he'd never gotten around to it.
But
so
he was
fantastic.
Carrying it around with him. So I do wonder about the symbolism, right? In
having
that book there. Right?
Well, Volcker was a very strong person, a very strong leader at a time when we really needed it. But in terms of clarifying things on where the Fed is, I think the whole thing was designed not to really push. What are you going to do next? So I would just refer everybody back not to the Q&A but to the speech, because I think what's important is at the very end, what does it mean being data dependent? He talks about all the good reasons why the economy is looking okay. But he says there are risks to this outlook, principally from global developments. Growth around much of the world has weakened over the past year and a half, uncertainties around trade, Brexit, et cetera. Rich Miller from our eco team in Washington wrote a story about the next recession is different because the U.S. may not be pushed there by domestic factors.
We talked about this at the top
right?
of our broadcast.
Okay. More about these global forces. I think it's so interesting that it dovetails here with what Jay Powell said. Fed's not on a preset course. So I think anybody who thinks October is a slam dunk, I don't know. It may be, but I think they're going to decide when they get there. But think one more thing. Chicago Fed President Charlie Evans wouldn't mind another 25 basis point rate cut. They're open, but I think it's a live meeting, but I think it's not 100% that they're going to move.
Well, Carl, and the point of Rich Miller's story is that if this recession is different this time around, it's not the usual forces, pushing us into recession, that limits the Fed in terms of what they can do. And I think that's the point that we've got to think about, right? The Fed has a certain set of tools. We know what their mandate is. They're watching inflation. They're watching the employment picture. But you do wonder if it's geopolitical, if it's trade tensions. There's just so much the Fed can do, especially if you start to have CEOs just concerned about the outlook and what it all means, holding back. There's not necessarily anything more the Fed can do to kind of make CEOs feel more confident.
Sure. Well, we've had recessions in the past that certainly have been caused by a lack of confidence and animal spirits in the corporate sector. So that's not unusual. What's unusual is that this could potentially be driven by some kind of collapse or sharp pullback in trade. And it's yet to be determined if that really is a possible way that we can move into recession, because consumer spending is such a lion's share of the economy that a weak trade landscape It can push Germany into recession. They're probably already there. It can push most of Europe into recession. They're on the brink. Japan, same story. China, same story. In the U.S., if we turn down the trade dial, if we turn down the business investment dial, we still have a consumer landscape that is enough for the economy to limp through without falling towards its stall speed. And so I'm not convinced that without a material pullback in job creation and income creation that we can actually see recession come about.
And you don't expect that.
And we don't expect that. We'd have to see a real pullback in hiring. I'm talking to something in the vicinity of 50 to 75,000 per month on non-farm payrolls, and we're well above that threshold for the time being. And just to reflect back on Powell's remarks here, he's making it abundantly clear that the asset purchases are coming very soon, imminently. Mm-hmm. I would expect that, my team expects that to happen at the October 30th FOMC meeting and to be implemented very shortly thereafter. And that's critical because at year end, you tend to have funding pressures exacerbated, and also liquidity tends to dry up because a lot of people shut their books for the year.
So the timing makes sense.
So the timing has to happen at some point in Q4, or else they run the risk that all of these temporary emergency measures will have to be dramatically ramped up as we go into year end. So this is a signal that the Fed is taking the measures to alleviate all those issues in the repo markets and whatnot.
And so, you heard Charlie give the market reaction. It's sometimes hard to distill down, what's influencing what on the markets. We saw the market, the S&P go up to its highs of the days and then pull back. There were some China-related headlines moving that as well. Did the market hear what it needed to, do you think, Kathleen, from J-Pal?
No, if the market thought it needed to hear real confirmation that there's definitely a cut in, 2.5 weeks, whenever that is, at the end of the month.
Didn't hear it.
And that the door is going to be open to another one in December, they definitely did not hear that. Better watch the economy, data dependent. And if Carl's right, if things aren't going to get a lot worse, I know that my dear Bloomberg Economics team is looking for two more rate cuts this year. I just wonder if they're all going to be on board for it. And in terms of China, that was not asked about in the Q&A.
Right.
It was not. He alluded to the fact that what the Fed's really watching now is how all these global forces are coming together. And you guys, it's very interesting to me. I was having a conversation with someone earlier saying, someone I was saying who was arguing for rate cuts. It wasn't you guys, but someone else who is, right? Well, what is that person? What do they think it's going to do? Weaken the dollar? And I said, I don't think it's that so much. I think it's more like if you think things are weakening, you take out the insurance, right? But Carl, I think that's what a lot of the naysayers are looking. Go ahead and cut rates, man. Cut them twice. What's it going to do? How do you answer that?
It's going to lower your mortgage rate. It's going to lower the cost of financing for any number of corporate projects. And it will also weaken the dollar and make U.S. exports more competitive. So rate cuts still work even in a low rate environment. And what was underscored, what was not explicitly written in this speech, what was very much the underlying theme of this speech is there's plenty of time before the next meeting, and we are watching to see what happens with trade negotiations.
Yeah,
and
you're exactly
the tea
right.
leaves have not looked good in that regard over the last couple of days, whether it's the MBA or blacklisting companies, et cetera, it doesn't look like we're moving towards detente.
Well, and it's interesting for him to say, the U.S. economy faces risks, but overall is in a good place. I feel like we got a lot of that things look okay, but,
and again
it really just harkens back to data
dependent. And that is code language, right? He's saying don't look at the unemployment rate to say we don't need rate cuts. He's talking about those risks, and as those risks, as the clouds darken, then the Fed takes insurance out against those risks. So anytime you hear him saying the risks are getting worse, that means they're taking more insurance out against that, which I think means they're going to have continue trimming rates. And if we look at the initial market reaction, look at the two-year yield, you definitely saw that come down on the remarks. So I think there was a little bit of a dovish tone that did get through to the markets.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Carl Riccadonna, Chief U.S. Economist for Bloomberg Economics, and Kathleen Hayes, Global Economics and Policy Editor for Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
All right, so Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, is here, as is Austin Carr, technology reporter for Bloomberg. And Austin's wearing a sweater, which apparently is necessary for his job, because consistently he is being sent to some very cold places to do some great reporting. He's here with us about a story. The CEO's promise to wire the Arctic concealed $1 billion scam. It's a fantastic read. So, Austin, what was going on, and have you warmed up?
This is actually my Arctic Explorer sweater. I'm glad that you made note of that. This story charts this company called Quintillion's quest to create a massive fiber optic network in Alaska, right around the tip of the coast in the Arctic, frigid, frozen most of the year round. And in the lower 48, we take the internet for granted. Right. We can watch Netflix. We can, you know, stream YouTube anytime we want. But up there in these really small, mostly native communities, you can't get access to the internet. You have dial-up speeds. It can cost hundreds, if not thousands of dollars just to get on the internet. And so this company sought out to build out this massive network that would not only connect Alaska, it would actually speed up the web for much of the planet by creating this Arctic web pipeline that would connect London to Asia. Most of the Arctic pipeline, the pipelines for the internet today go through either the Atlantic or the Pacific, very similar route. So this would have been a disruptive route that would have been a shorter distance from London to Asia.
The promise of the Northwest Passage.
Exactly.
Maybe you've heard this tale before.
I have, yeah. The Northwest Passage, it was just as grueling back 100 years ago when explorers went there as it is now. The difference is climate change. It's a little bit warmer, opened up paths. You can actually lay down fiber optic cable under the water, but for a very limited portion of the year. And that's where the story starts.
So talk about this company a little bit more, because they attracted some interesting investors. And then there was a leader who was making some promises.
So the co-founder of this company, Elizabeth Pierce, is the CEO of Quintillion. And she really drove this mission forward to build out this transarctic internet pipeline. They raised $270 million to bring this dream to life from some very high-profile investors, including one of their backers was Len Blatnikov, the Ukrainian oligarch, many would call him, who owns Warner Music Group. He was one of the big investors, and you might ask, why was he interested in this data pipeline? And that's because shortening this distance between the continents lowers latency and could provide huge upside to cloud players, to high-frequency traders, just shaving off milliseconds in internet speeds. The issue was, he was actually sold on this idea by Elizabeth Pierce, the CEO, who had essentially forged contracts over the course of several years. She was selling all these sort of major sales contracts to their investors to raise all these funds. But it turns out, after our investigation, these things didn't really exist. She had fabricated the entire thing, which is one of the things we get deeper into in the story.
Which is actually, like, it takes a turn. And it starts with the first document that she forged. And by the end of it, how many documents has she forged?
It was, give or take, let's say at least eight. And we're talking, I mean, these are contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Yes. These are not tiny contracts. These are ones you'd want to check out.
What was she thinking?
And did you say contracts worth more than $1 billion?
In aggregate.
Altogether. Yeah. Altogether.
In aggregate.
Yeah.
In aggregate. It was a $1 billion scam. So what was she thinking?
I mean, that's the big question. We talked to more than 3 dozen people for the story who were very close to her, and they describe her as extremely rigorous, but also extremely secretive. She did not allow any of her coworkers into meetings with investors. One source had told us then when one of her employees started to share too much data about accounting with her investors by phone, she kicked him very harshly under the table to stop him from doing so. She had a private filing cabinet that she scolded one employee from opening at one time. So she was very secretive, but you could also say so wasn't Steve Jobs, so wasn't any Silicon Valley entrepreneur.
But she also brought in people she knew, and I would assume liked, to make investments in a company that she knew was built on fraud, right?
She not only brought in high-profile investors, but also individuals who were her employers, who were her family's friends. And that's where I think that the turn that Joel is talking about. I mean, you see how personal this fraud gets when you start to bring in people who are, not billionaire investors, but just local Alaskans who thought this had huge upside for the state, invested their family's retirement funds in it, and lost all their money as a result.
And so where does the company stand now? It's got a new leader because this is still a pretty important project for a lot of people.
So the crazy thing is, if you compare this to any fraud, whether that's Theranos or any other high profile project that sort of fell apart, the difference is there was something behind the curtain here. Elizabeth Pierce, the CEO of this company, actually, despite all her fraud, ended up building out this fiber optic network in Alaska. So that's what makes it really fascinating. We spent a lot of time up in Anchorage, up in the northernmost community in Alaska, which is called Barrow. I can't actually pronounce how it's...
And by we, Austin means him.
It's the capital we.
Wearing sweaters and snow boots.
Several layers.
And this is freezing up there. But at the same time, you go up and you see, wow, these people actually have internet access. This is pretty phenomenal that despite all this fraud, this thing actually came to life, which is a lot different than a Theranos where, there was actually no blood testing kit or anything like that.
And the project might actually keep going, right? Like there's the effort to try and do Alaska, but it could still have a larger reach than that, right?
So the current CEO who took over, he's a former Army vet. He was brought in days after this fraud was uncovered internally, and he completed the network with ships in the Arctic who are building these things under ice. And I'd say he's a straight shooter. They have big potential if they can only build this thing out. The problem is it's going to cost $800 million more dollars to do so.
And what happened to Elizabeth?
Elizabeth Pierce, as of last week, was just sentenced to 5 years in jail.
There you go.
So, moral of story, don't forge billions of contracts.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
Not even for Netflix.
But do read Austin Carr's story. It's a really nice narrative and an important one. Austin Carr, tech reporter for Bloomberg, his story in this week's edition of Bloomberg BizWeek online and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And that's what we want to find out from our next guest. We always learn something when Joe Kalish stops by. He's chief global macro strategist at Ned Davis Research, based in Venice, Florida, back in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio right here in New York City. Welcome back.
Thanks, Carol.
So you sent over a bunch of research, and I've been looking through it. We talk about the repo mess. You take a look at the labor market. And you also talk about corporate credit risks rising.
Yep.
How do you see this environment when you add it all up right now?
So if I look at the sort of the biggest risks, there's no shortage of risks out there, as we know. A lot of those are geopolitical. But a lot of these are known, right? The trade war, that's what's going on. What's bothering me most acutely right now is some of this ramping up of these non-tariff barriers, right? Because this is opens up a whole new front in the trade, the trade war and the war with China, basically.
That doesn't get fixed, even if the trade war gets resolved.
Get that fixed quickly,
yeah.
Right? So this is going to be a long-term issue. It's going to be with us, at least until the election, probably. I don't see how China is going to cave in quickly. The other risks we all know about with Brexit and Hong Kong and all those. But then when I look at what's going on in terms of profit margins, when we eliminate some of those distortions that we had from the tax law, we see the profit margins actually peaked in 2014. So we've been eroding on profit margins. So we use this measure called unit profits, and profit margins have been eroding for 5 years now. And we're actually back down to the level. So we went from 15% to 11%. We're back down to the levels about where we were at the start of the last recession. So we could go lower, but we're essentially eroding the cushion. And the other point that I was making in that piece that you referenced is that the interest coverage ratio has also been eroding. So we were at 5.5 times mm-hmm. a few years ago, and now we're at 4.3 times, which is the exact average over the last 50 years. And what we've seen is that when you start dropping below that level, then you run into a greater risk of recession. So again, it doesn't mean that we're going to have a recession tomorrow, but right. it means that the cushion is being eroded such that if we get a downside shock to the economy, there's not much of a cushion left to absorb that shock, and then it's easier to get into a fall into a recession.
And so, Joe, one of the pieces of data certainly that people look at very closely and are, I feel like, continuing to try and synthesize is the monthly jobs report. We saw that on Friday.
Right.
How did that fit into the other elements that you're seeing that you take into account when you're trying to predict where we go next?
Right. So when we look at the job market, it's very important piece for calling a recession, because you can't have a recession without people losing jobs. And we really haven't seen anybody lose their job yet. Yeah. So there were a few things that sort of bothered me in the employment report that came out on Friday that we were pointing out. First of all, everybody knows that average hourly earnings for all workers slowed from 3.2% to 2.9%. But that wasn't in the bulk of the labor force, which are production and non-supervisory employees, which account for 80% of the labor force. Their average hourly earnings basically stayed at 3.5%. So the weakness was occurring in what we call supervisor and manager pay. And that just seems a bit odd that that would be slowing down. So my interpretation is not that these people are getting less compensation, but they're getting it in non-monetary forms. We're going to pay for your health care. We're going to give you extra time off. We're going to give you stock options. So there are other ways of compensating people other than giving them an actual increase to their base, which is what gets calculated in average hourly earnings. So that was one thing that bothered me. The weakest sector of the economy, manufacturing, hasn't shown any real net job loss.
Yeah.
Now, we've seen a little bit of erosion in the average work week and overtime hours, but basically we're back to where we were before the tax cuts hit and where we were in 2017. So, we really haven't seen a material weakness. And so if the companies aren't letting go of their labor, we don't see any uptick in unemployment claims, and the unemployment rate fell to a new low, it gives us some breathing room in terms of when that next recession could hit. And I think that's some of the points that we were raising in that.
So conclusion is you don't see a recession anytime soon.
We don't see a recession anytime soon, but clearly, the risks have risen over the last year. And so the probability of recession has increased, but we are not calling for recession at this time. We don't feel we have enough evidence to make that call. In order to make that call, you need the consumer to cave in.
Right.
And that happens with the job losses or erosion in wealth.
Now, Jay Powell said earlier in his comments, I was just looking for it verbatim, but basically to the point of, maybe they're seeing some signs of slowness, but there's no reason why things kind of can't keep going along at this rate.
Right. And actually, one of the other pieces that I was looking at in Friday's employment report that is really kind of unusual here is we've seen very, very strong growth in household employment, right? Mm. So there's two surveys. There's the household survey and the establishment survey. And the household survey has been much stronger. In fact, we had the equivalent of, and when you take the household survey and make it into the establishment concept, we had the equivalent of 1 million jobs created in August and almost another 300,000 last month. And now normally the trends of household employment and establishment employment run together.
Right.
They are at their widest gap now since July of 2009. And that's very unusual. So we don't really know what the reason is. It could be that there are the birth-death model is not giving us enough jobs, and that there are people are finding jobs that are not being counted in the establishment.
See, we always get a lot.
I know.
Thank you so much. Joe Kalish, Chief Global Macro Strategist at Ned Davis Research, based in Venice, Florida, but in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio today. This is why the data points, as a mass, you might see one thing, but you got to pick apart.
This is why Jay Powell's job is hard, and why they've got a lot
to look
at. This is
what he does on the weekend. He says he reads these kinds of reports.
2.5 weeks are going to be big. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. So we're very fortunate because we have some colleagues here who really have their eye on all the elements of the luxury market, Chris Rouser being chief among them, and actually hat tip to him for this next guest. Brian Duffy is the CEO of Watches of Switzerland. He's based in London, but here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. His company recently went public. He's going to tell us about that and also what to expect in the luxury market. Great to have you with us.
No, thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
All right. So going public, that's not something that necessarily we're always talking to luxury watchmakers about. So what brought you to the public markets?
We were private equity owned, owned by a big US group, Apollo. So we were going to go somewhere. And and I think going public was a great thing for this business. It gives certainty about ownership, lower leverage, high accountability, high governance. So I think it was a good move to make, and it's gone pretty well.
What I love talking about your kind of company is we get a feel of what's going on, certainly in the global economy, and certainly what's going on within the luxury global economy. Yep. What are you guys seeing when you look around the world?
You know what, the luxury watch market's a bit of a one-off, I think, in many ways. It's more supply-constrained than it is demand-constrained, mm-hmm. and I don't think people fully realize that. It's pretty much a Swiss monopoly, so it has the peculiarities that come from that. But right now, there's never been such a demand for luxury watches in the world.
Europe, Asia, North America, everywhere?
Everywhere. And I think that's what's unusual about it. I think in the past, you maybe had good demand in the US, but maybe Asia's down, whatever. But globally, the world are very interested in having more mechanical, precious luxury watches, and there really hasn't been the response from a production standpoint to meet that demand. So today we have more products on waiting list than we've ever had at any time in our history.
Talk to us about retail, because you're uniquely positioned to talk about this, in part because part of your background is you worked a very senior level group president for Polo Ralph Lauren across yep. Europe and the Middle East, so you understand retail pretty intimately. How does that play through in the current iteration with this particular market?
This market again is peculiar in that, well, first of all, not all brands allow their product to be sold online. So immediately you don't have that competition. And even those that do, you've got to have bricks and mortar to be an authorized retailer. So it's a protected industry, which I think is good. It's not really threatened by a pure play and so on. It's also a product where people are spending a lot of money on a luxury watch for a special occasion in their life. They really want to take their time and do it. So we think we have a formula in retail, customer service, really taking time with customers, giving them a great choice, giving them great expertise from our team. Trying on watches, a lot of research is done online, but until you actually get there and put it on your wrist, you don't know if it's a watch for you. So the right kind of retail bricks and mortar environment still really works for this category very well.
Brian, I'm always curious if there are certain brands that really resonate with certain high-end consumers around the world. So like in America, what's the watch or watch brands? Is there a couple that are tend to be more dominant than others in terms of sales?
Yes. I mean, the best and the biggest luxury watch brand in the world, America included, is Rolex. It's a wonderful product. It's indestructible. It's super cool, as you can see from the nice Daytona that I'm wearing now. It doesn't always look
wait.
This good.
I've got an Apple Watch, and you got a Fitbit on, right?
Yeah, that's okay. I noticed right away.
I have to say, I have some really good watches at home, and I'm feeling very guilty of late. My teenage daughter all of a sudden is like, hey, can I have this? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to see. I mean, that doesn't impact this kind of world, or does it?
Really not luxury watches. We know it as a matter of fact that it doesn't from our business, but we also got, leading up to the IPO, we got some research done that said it too, which is exactly your case, that people who have luxury watches who also have a smartwatch, they're very different occasions. Mm-hmm. You don't go out to impress your friends with your smartwatch on. You put something nice on there. So it's very mechanical luxury Swiss watch is very different world to a smart technology.
When you think about sort of the geopolitical world we're living in, think about a place like Hong Kong. Yep. You know, luxury feels like is something that could candidly suffer as those protests go on. How does that play through in your estimation?
It results in it being the most volatile part of the global market. It's the biggest market for Swiss watch exports. It's the biggest in the world.
Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Have you seen an impact?
Well, we're not in Hong Kong. We're UK and US, but it's publicized. There's been a very significant impact overall. The empirical data we all look at every month is the Swiss watch exports. You get that by product type, by a country, and the numbers are down in Hong Kong for very obvious reasons. The Chinese are not going there, not shopping.
Right.
So, yes, and as a result, it's been an excellent market over the years, but then it can really get hit by, you know, this kind of unfortunate activity.
So how many watches do you have, Brian Duffy?
I have around 12, 13 watches.
Right. Yeah. And, it's like a reasonable amount for the CEO of a watch company.
Never enough.
It's about the same amount that in terms of sneakers.
Yeah, I probably have the same amount of sneakers.
Just, you know, while you mentioned sneakers, we're doing a big collaboration with sneakers, with the difficult-to-get sneakers that people are buying like for $4,000 or $5,000.
It's become a luxury item.
Yeah, so down in our store in Green Street here in New York, we're doing an event matching sneakers and the luxury
watches. All right, we'll have to check it out.
You must come along.
That's very cool.
Brian Duffy, CEO, Watches of Switzerland, based in London, here in New York City with us.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, it's time for the Drive to the Close. Greg Lucan back with us, founder, chief executive officer of Lucan Investment Analytics, based down in lovely Nashville, Tennessee, here with us in New York City today.
Do they actually call it Nash Vegas?
Some people do.
We do.
Do you?
We do, yeah.
Why?
Because it's like a boomtown.
It's a total boomtown.
Well, what's going on?
Sort of a party town too.
Well, we do love when people come from, you know, not necessarily New York or the West Coast to kind of get a feel of what's going on. What's going on in Nashville in terms of the economy? And what are the things that are on top of mind for everyone, whether it's a business owner, whether it's an investor, homeowner?
Well, like a lot of cities, they're growing. You know, there's just a lot more people, so there's a push to get infrastructure to support that. We've got a lot of people moving in from other states because there is no state income tax, and so it's a right-to-work state, and we have an educated workforce, Vanderbilt. Nashville's called the Athens of the South,
right?
And there's a lot of research there. There's a lot of publishing. It's kind of a tech hub as well, so...
So nobody's talking about recession?
Not in Nashville, no. Yeah. Not at all.
Well, and you've been the beneficiary of a lot of sort of in-migration. I mean, from New York, you've had Alliance Bernstein, I believe, is moving a whole bunch of people down there. You've even had, it feels like, some folks moving from elsewhere in the South, from Atlanta and Charlotte and elsewhere, you know, trying to capture, candidly, some of the... stuff that's going on there that may have been happening in Atlanta and Charlotte a few years ago. The only problem is they're going to turn it into the next Atlanta or Charlotte. Right?
Well, we hope not. The biggest immigration right now is coming in from California and Michigan.
Michigan. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it has to do with climate.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with tax levels.
Right.
Yeah, I think
that's
a big deal. All right, so let's talk a little bit about, you know, we've talked about kind of, you set the economic scene there. Talk to us about the market scene right now, because we've had an interesting day. We were kind of kidding with you that we're kind of fed up with Fed a little bit. But it was great to hear from Jay Powell, because I think everyone's trying to figure out, okay, what's next in terms of the Federal Reserve? What kind of visibility, Greg, do you feel like you have when it comes to the investment environment right now?
Well, I think the temptation sometimes is to get really frustrated. You know, we've gone sideways for a long time. A lot of investors have looked at their statements and, and they're saying they're not as good now as they were in January of 2018. And I think it's good to step back and realize that if we look statistically at the market, going back on the Dow for 120 years, the market spends about 80% of its time declining and recovering from those declines, just kind of going sideways like we have in the last couple of years. And only 20% of that time is actually spent creating that new wealth. But that 20% of the time is so powerful. You have to make sure you have a strategy to where you are in to capture that. And
so what is that strategy to capture that?
Well,
at least in this environment right now.
I think in this environment, you have to look at where's the risk high and where's the risk low. And, you know, you're even seeing developed international markets, particularly Europe today, last night, not moving down like the U.S. Market. Emerging markets, they're lost today about half of what the international markets are. Broad-based commodities and gold, you see people moving there for a safe haven. So really to kind of keep that powder dry or protect against some of those declines, beginning to scale from U.S. equities into some other asset classes that haven't done well for a long time.
Talk to us about small caps, because I feel like we've been having that conversation sort of repeatedly, trying to get our head around, like, is it really that bad out there for small caps? It feels like it might be. It feels like a place maybe not to be playing.
It's not. You know, years ago, there was a first lady, Nancy Reagan, who came up with a program that was, her slogan was just say no. Mm-hmm. That was to drugs. But we believe in just saying no to small caps. We've been saying that for years. We think there's a
That's
time.
That's the first Nancy Reagan reference I think we've had on the show
like,
in quite
some
time.
Where you go with this?
Well done.
I had to do a little setup there because...
Yeah,
so just say no to small caps?
Just say no to small caps.
Why do you hate them so much?
Well, A, I think we're in the wrong part of the economy for small cap stocks. And if you look even at the equal weighted S&P versus the cap weighted S&P, you've seen a big underperformance of the equal weighted for the last 5 years. So it's really the capitalization weighted that has led the market. The small cap stocks, especially small cap value, have had much more risk and much less return than the NASDAQ or the S&P or even the NASDAQ. Stack 100.
And so what are you bullish on at this point? Europe, you said?
I think Europe looks really interesting. It might be a mischaracterization to say I'm bullish on it.
Yeah.
I think it looks really interesting. You know, this month we've got Brexit scheduled to happen at the end of the month. You got earnings season that happens here in full swing next week. So I think particularly, the UK, Germany, they look really interesting, forming a really nice base, close to support, look interesting there.
You know, it's interesting. Right. You sent some notes, too, over that takes a look at, you know, decline and recover time. So, I mean, I think about the technology space where I think you could get a healthy debate on any given day. What's your take on that? Because some are saying, okay, it's overvalued. They've had their run up. That's not where I want to put new money. Others say, well, these are the growth engines going forward. Just got about 30 seconds, 40 seconds.
Thank you. They are the growth engines, and you have to go where the growth is. I mean,
so you would commit new money there?
We do.
Yeah. All right. We're going to leave it there. Greg Lucan, founder and chief executive officer of Lucan Investment Analytics.
He had a few more seconds.
Yeah, he had a few more seconds. Wow. Carol was very generous and gave him 30 for one answer.
It's a lot of time.
You love running down the clock.
It's a lot of time broadcast time, and he did just fine.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it.
Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.